time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. I'm Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here to talk about the eighth episode of HBO's The Leftovers. This one is called International Assassin.
I am so, so happy that we had a Kevin-centered episode here. I was super nervous that they were going to take a page out of so many of our other mainstream shows right now who are taking a main character and questioning whether or not this person is dead or not and then dragging us along.
Yeah, they kind of toyed with
weeks
us.
Weeks after weeks.
And Damon was actually teased, if you recall, a couple weeks ago after The Walking Dead, how Scott Gimple teased how he said how when Glenn was maybe dead, maybe not, he said, we'll see parts of Glenn, maybe blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And Damon came and he made some similar comment.
That there would be some like what was the word he used? Like in...
We'll see parts of Kevin, maybe in Sue. He made some.
It was killing me.
But it was, he made some comment to parody Scott Gimple's comment in a way to make fun of him and tease at us.
Also, last episode, episode 7, they played like sort of like the normal for next week type of clips like they would have. And
almost nothing from this episode.
No, I think there was nothing. I mean, it was all like, you know, things about mostly Tommy and Meg. And so I thought, oh, my God, please don't send us back to Mapleton to sit around at
a GR
meeting. Oh, my God. Wonderful tease. And they hit it very well. I mean, there's lots of times when Twitter or, you know, personal actors accounts and things, you know, will put a picture or say something about it that it's like, oh, man. You know, we get a little spoiled on accident. And this time, I had no idea that this episode was coming. I was so happy for it.
This reminded me of, what does it always remind me of? Lost.
Well, I mean, yes, for sure. But there were so many other great sci-fi and other movies and books and everything that you pulled out as we were watching that. I think it's an homage to a whole lot of different things, including music, lots of different things.
So let's get into it.
So we have our opening scene of a water faucet in a bathtub and it's dripping. And with great dramatics, a body sits up out of the tub.
It reminded us of a birth. It's like an eruption of...
It's like the water breaks, right?
Yeah.
Literally, like the surface of the water breaks.
Because the water is even with the top of the tub.
And it's calm at first.
And right, it's just... perfectly calm, and then the body comes right up out of it and then slides out the side of the like
no person you've ever seen exit a tub.
No.
Now, I mean, I recognize that part of this is like, you know, they have to be modest for old Justin Theroux's man parts, and so they found a way for him to sort of slither out of the side of the tub so that he could kind of stay on his stomach the entire time.
But to me, it reminded me of like when we're at the Texas, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo when they show a calf being birthed.
Yeah, we have to explain so we are here in Houston and they have a livestock area during the rodeo where it's fully a birthing area. Every single animal there is giving birth during the rodeo. On the Jumbotron. And so we always take the kids over there to check it out so we can sort of, you know, broach some of those sensitive subjects of how are babies born.
They do not let the mystery be.
They do not let the mystery be. No, not at all. The mystery is all exposed up in your face. So we've seen piglets be born and everything, but Paul is right. There is one animal, the way a calf is born, when it comes out, it looks just like the way Kevin came slithering out of the side. It's kind of crazy. But for all of you Justin Theroux fans out there, I know you were like me and being like, come on now, we've seen Matt, we've seen Tommy. It is about time that we see JT Jr.
This also reminded me of something else. And I know it seems a little early to jump into this kind of thing, but it reminded me of it at this moment anyway. It reminded me of another movie that is not as popular, but it did. Constantine, which deals with using bodies, small bodies of water like tubs, as portals between our plane, and he uses it to get back and forth between hell.
Whoa.
Yes. And so I set off looking, and there is plenty to find here. In Welsh and Celtic tradition, it is believed in those tribes way back when that lakes and any body of water, that those could be used as portals to, guess where? The spirit world.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And
it's so weird because in our modern days, like, I never think, like, I'm going to go down to the lake because, like, I feel like grandma could, like, talk to me from beyond there. It's weird, but I agree with you. Like, definitely, it seems like, you know, water is definitely representative of life in many ways.
In popular media, besides Constantine, that seminal work of film, it's been also used in another piece of modern movie making known as Hot Tub Time Machine.
Oh, no, yeah, sure.
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 Get a little Hot Tub Time Machine going.
But more popularly in writing, any kind of body of water, also in the works of the Narnia world. I've not read Narnia. That's a blind spot for me, but a lot of people have, and that's a big thing in Narnia. Did you read Narnia?
I did not. And so Narnia as well is Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe series?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. I mean, definitely I had marked down Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe later. So wow. So I didn't know. So bodies of water are important in Narnia as well?
Yes.
Ah.
Okay. That does seem to resonate in just about 5 minutes, right?
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So Kevin gets up. He's in a hotel room. This is not the last thing he remembers. He gets up, he starts looking around, and what does he find after being birthed from this body of water? A wardrobe.
Yes. Well, so first, while he's trying to kind of get his bearings right, he puts that towel there to protect his little self, and proceeds.
Kevin Jr. Right. Kevin Jr. Jr.
Right. Jr., right. Right. Well, so that'd be the third. We'll call him Trip then, right? That's what you call the third. Okay, so Trip is covered. So he starts walking around. The way the camera is moving around, I am ready for a reveal of somebody else in that room because they're kind of just painting it a little bit over, a little bit over. The first thing I notice is like a ton of water bottles are sitting on the sort of end table area. And I thought that was odd. Like, I know they give you one or two, like, complimentary, but there was like 10
water bottles. And is this the first time that the TV goes nuts? Just
yeah, because they're building some tension with the way that they're doing the camera angles around the room. When they shoot it kind of over towards the bed, I fully expected there to be someone else in bed. I don't know why, I don't know who, but I thought maybe Lori, like maybe this was an alternate reality of like where him and Lori stayed together or something, and that whole GR thing didn't happen.
Right, because the colors are
fully
off.
Yeah.
And with the colors kind of being that higher contrast or filmy look that isn't
And we just know that Kevin is not all about being faithful in his marriage. So I was just so fully ready as that pan to the bed for there to be...
The dear woman.
Anybody. The dear woman would have been perfect, honestly. So anyway, as the tension's sort of building and my eyes are just searching for who else is in this room, that's when the TV starts squealing.
He sees this wardrobe and it's got this big brass placard on it. And he reads it because the camera focuses on it for all to see.
It does. It's very Alice in Wonderland, like, eat me, drink this, sit here.
And it says, know first who you are and adorn yourself accordingly.
I kind of love this, and I think that it could be a beautiful life lesson. If you're a parent out there, I completely feel like it should be on every single child's wardrobe anywhere. But even for the rest of us who are trying to figure out every day, like, what do we want out of this world? What do you want out of today? You know, there's sort of in modern days, they say, like, dress for the job you want, that type of thing. I completely feel like this is a big deal, you know?
This fits nicely with a lot of this kind of story, right? Where you come to sort of this holding area, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, definitely Alice in Wonderland-ish.
And you have to decide your very first step. And that's a very pivotal first step because when he opens up the wardrobe, he has to make a decision. He has to know himself and adorn himself accordingly, because inside there are four different outfits. And when I saw the outfits, I thought to myself, this kind of lines up with, and this is my nerd flag waving proudly, with something kind of like a role-playing game career choice.
You just own it, Paul. Just be all, I'm Dungeons and Dragons crazy. So it's all good. So here's the thing. So the first choice is what appears to be what I noted as like a religious garb of some sort. So in Dungeons and Dragons, the character options coincided with this. So this religious outfit would take the role of the cleric. Then the next outfit that was an option for him was a fully white shirt and white pants. So for us within the show, we consider that GR wear, certainly. I also consider that like a cult person. And so we put that under the category of this magic person or a wizard type role, which is more about that person is physically weak, but that they use other methods to manipulate people. And I definitely feel like that's fully what that outfit represents. The next one I wrote down as business suit. I know we'll come to name that job differently, but this one we wrote down as rogue. Rogue is interesting because rogue has very specific skills and they have a specific attack, right, Paul?
Yeah.
So this is exactly...
We'll find out later what they are, but in some games, they might fit like a spy or something like that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So, and kind of like, you know, 007-ish too. And then the last outfit is his Mapleton police outfit, which I wrote down like law establishment, this type of thing. Within Dungeons and Dragons, that role would be the fighter. So we have the choices of cleric, this wizard, a rogue, or a fighter. So he really takes some time. He really flies right past cleric and the GR outfit. But he spends a moment like kind of looking over the Mapleton police officer outfit before he's like, you know what? That's not really me either. So I don't know if he's choosing it or if it was like, do you think it was more of like a dismissing, like I'm not one or two and I don't think I'm number four anymore. So I'll pick three.
That's what it looked like to me.
That's what I'm going with.
Yeah. He decides what to put on since he doesn't want to wear his towel anymore. And he gets a knock on the door. It's someone asking for Mr. Harvey.
So he corrects him and he's all, you know, Mr. Garvey. And he's like, no, Mr. Harvey.
When Kevin goes to get the flowers, Caroline goes, ooh, funeral flowers.
Yeah, that is exactly what I said. I was like, funeral flowers? What's that all about? So him calling him Mr. Harvey, couple ideas on that. The first thing that came to mind, because I am by trade an elementary school teacher, I thought H comes after G. Like, so after you're Garvey, in your next life, you're Harvey, right? Like, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah, right? That was my first thought. Then secondly, and I tweeted this, I put Kevin Harvey Oswald, right? I, like, start, like, monkeying around with this. Like, what are the Harveys we know? So we talked about it. So then the next one that Paul hollered out was Harvey the Rabbit, the Jimmy Stewart movie where... Jimmy Stewart is kind of a drunk and he starts talking to
an imaginary rabbit.
Or might we say invisible rabbit? I don't know. But so here's the thing, though. Nobody else can see it. So obviously all of these things are feeling like, okay, what are we dealing with here?
They all seem to apply in
they do
Kevin Harvey's case.
In their own weird little ways. So the lilies are delivered. And I looked this up. Lilies are, within Christianity, they're a symbol of resurrection. So I definitely think of them as funeral flowers, mainly because they're white, and that's like commonly what you find at a funeral. But then also, Easter time is when you commonly see lilies, and resurrection is a big deal during that time. Obviously, that's the whole Easter celebration. One of the things that I found that I thought were really neat was that as Jesus was walking through the gardens and his tears were falling and sweat, as the sweat fell, wherever they fell onto the ground, lilies would grow right there from that spot. So they were considered like magical flowers. So I thought that was like another little layer of like, okay, obviously we know Easter lilies. We understand that they're symbolism of resurrection, but then also they're kind of magical.
I did not know the magical part. I just knew the Easter part.
Well, consider your mind blown, as Elizabeth would say.
Partially blown. Yes. As Kevin retreats into the room to try to find the man a tip, the man catches the door and follows him in, which is sort of not a cool move.
Well, especially because he actually said, wait. I'll take them.
Right.
I'll be right back.
I'd like you to wait here, sir.
Right. I mean, typically, you know, the help does not like come busting into your hotel room. Because, like, what if you had, like, some nudity going on in there or something?
Kevin looks into his wallet and all he has is euros.
Right. Strange. And no identification that we could see.
And a monkey knife fight ensues.
Yeah. So the help decides to just go banana sandwich on him and starts attacking.
Luckily, Kevin has moves that we did not know Kevin had.
Oh, all of a sudden he's like a judo master. So he totally like pulls out some kung fu biz and takes this much larger man down.
All he has to show for it is a cut up hand.
Yeah. What? How do you even get cut? I don't even know.
Well, the other man had a knife.
Oh, I totally missed the knife. I knew he had a weapon, but I didn't realize it was a knife.
That's what makes it a monkey knife fight.
Got it. That makes sense now. We say monkey knife fight in our own home, meaning just a fight. It doesn't usually involve a knife. So hilarious. Well, this leads old Kev to kind of be like panting and wandering over to a very, very well-stocked bar area that has medicines, mending kits, a wonderful array of medications, including like Tums and Listerine, just everything. So he doctors up his ham
and heads out.
He puts the do not disturb sign on his door as to not have any maids wander in on our dead body here, and hurries at a pretty quick pace down to the elevators.
Where, when he gets there, the fire alarm starts going off. Instead of using the elevator, he decides to take the stairs. You know, safety first when you're in wherever he is.
Right? So I love the music playing at this point. It did an amazing job of having these like massive crescendos right when the fire alarm goes off. It was fantastical.
These gigantic orchestra hits. These.
Yeah, it was fantastic. That's awesome, Paul. It's like I'm listening to the music right now.
I know.
You should record that and we could sell it.
I know.
I love that poem.
We could have a credit.
Yeah.
At the end of the podcast.
I love it. Love it. Love it. So it turns out that old Kev's on the fourth floor. So he's got quite a bit of stairs to go down. It's kind of an open staircase down into the lobby. So he's kind of overlooking the complex as he's walking down.
And he notices a little girl standing at the edge of the pool, looking into it ominously.
Yeah. As a parent, that's like, you're way too close to the pool, chick.
Not wearing a swimsuit, wearing just a kind of a weird flower pattern dress.
Well, you know, let's talk about that just for a second, because as soon as I saw her standing there, her silhouette and her hair, I immediately had a flash to The Shining. Paul was not so sure that that was a very good image to flash into my brain, so he questioned me. But good news, I found an awesome image online to show him, like, no, seriously. That dress is very unusual. We have two daughters. I've never seen that dress in the stores of like today, modern day. So I wanted to show them. And you know what? It's like identical to the dress that the twin girls wear in the hallway of The Shining. And her hair, while not perfectly the same, is very, very similar. Just add a layer of boogie woogie to it.
If you say so.
He walks on over to the front desk lady, who is distracted at this point.
Everyone in the lobby is just totally distracted by a single bird flapping around, tweeting. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry. There's a bird. He's like, I understand. Someone sent me flowers. Can you figure out who sent me flowers?
I love the wording she uses for that. She says, all deliveries come through the concierge. We glance over to the concierge and guess who's there?
Verge.
The Verge. Not only that, but guess who was walking right in front of Verge?
I don't know. Who was it?
Two uniformed firefighters are walking right by Verge as we glance over at him, which was like, wow. That's like all we saw in Miracle this past couple of weeks has been firefighters and Virgil.
Kev heads over to Virgil. We have a totally different Virgil. This is a clean-cut looking Virgil who speaks with a nice clear tone, and he doesn't seem to know what's going on at all. Kevin's like, cut the shit. Tell me what is happening. Virgil writes out a note that says, parking garage, 5 minutes.
I super love Virgil, though, because he plays it so cool. And Kevin's giving him the, like, tell me what's going on. He's like, Well, we have a false alarm on the fire alarm, and there's a bird loose in the lobby. Like, as if to say, like, why don't you catch my drift, son?
Before Kevin leaves, he says, I really hope they don't catch that bird.
So did you totally think, like, is this a bird that is buried and is flying around here? And, like, the whole deal is hopefully in 3 days that bird's gonna, like, I don't know, find its way out of the lobby. Hopefully that's, like, when Erica digs it up.
I didn't until you said that.
Well, I totally think that that's the deal, right? Because it's definitely, like, seeming like that's the situation. And that's, to me, why Virgil would be like, I really hope they don't catch it. Because basically, if they catch it, it feels like then that's when it's a dead bird. But, like, when the bird, like, comes, if they don't catch it after 3 days, it just, like, disappears suddenly. I think that's when Erica...
Remember what I was saying about Michael the Archangel?
Yeah.
The Redeemer?
Yeah, what about
like, him? Let's come back to that later. Before Kevin gets to the garage, he passes by the pool again, and guess who he sees face down in the water? Flower dress girl.
Yeah. I felt super sad. Did it scare you a little bit, V? Was it just like totally like, whatever?
Well, this is kind of a wiggity place, so seeing flower dress girl down face down in the water wasn't exactly like, you know, an unforeseen event.
I think it's more from like a parenting point of view that it was like, well, she was out there.
And then they played the music. It was like, ah, like, come on.
Nice. So you got a musical cue there for you.
So after, it was like an Escher staircase trying to get out there. It was like, bum, 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 bum. Trying to get all the way around.
Yeah.
Finally, he gets there, fishes her out, does a couple of pumps on the chest, and then back to life.
Man, I thought he had to work hard to get her back to life. He never did, like, the breathing thing, but apparently the new CPR focuses much more on the pumping of the chest and much less on the breathing.
Yeah, people out there, if you thought CPR was, like, say, 6 compressions to 2 breaths, it's, no way.
It's like 100 compressions.
Go back to school, people. Read a book, people.
It's all about getting that heart pumping again. Forget about your lungs.
So when a big guy comes around the corner and sees Kevin hugging on to this little girl fished out of the pond with her dress kind of pulled up, he's instantly suspicious.
Yeah, he's all like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
And Kevin's like, she was drowning. Mr. Appreciative's like, mind your business.
Yeah, no, he totally yells at the girl. He's like, I told you you couldn't swim. And he's like, God, like, Kevin's all, ease up, you know? It was an accident. And he's like, mind your effing business. Immediately, we all hate fat guy, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean.
We think he's super dick, right?
Totally. We've returned dogs to guys like that before.
And we're always like, give us
back that dog.
Yeah, no, we seriously have. Where we've, like, found a stray dog and, like, we find the owner and we return it. And literally, the owner, like, slaps the dog and we're like, what did we just do?
Yeah. So anyway, Kevin feels like us at that
moment. Yeah, like he just got slapped in the nose with the newspaper, man. So he heads on down to the parking garage, and on his way to the parking garage, down sort of these ramps, he passes two women who are speaking Spanish. And according to our friend, they are sort of saying, the one is saying that she's concerned and she's nervous because she's not a doctor and she doesn't really know how she's going to do this.
But when they see Kevin, they hush.
Yeah, not that it... Oh, but you know what? Actually, Kevin does know Spanish, doesn't he?
He does.
We learned that from a previous episode, so it's a good thing they shut their traps.
A familiar white Mercedes down the lane flashes its lights. Kevin goes over to it and gets in.
Now, hold up here. Do you think this white Mercedes is Evie's?
I think it's a white Mercedes that the production company owns, and it might as well. It's not Evie's. It's Evie's friends.
Yeah, but still. So guess what? I have news for you. There's a license plate check, and it is the same car. So forget this. Like, the production company owns it. No, dude. It's the character's car.
Okay.
What's the character's car doing in Limbo Land? Or wherever the hell we are. This hotel. What is it doing there?
It's convenient. I'm not getting too tied up about cars in Limbo Land.
I'm not tied up about cars. I'm tied up about who else might be there. Do you think Evie and the girls are there? Are they also at the hotel? Does this mean they're dead? Is this a hint that they're dead? A clue that they're dead?
I don't think cars are that big a deal about it.
So if they find the car and like my dead body, like forget that car. Yeah. Cars are not a big deal.
I mean, your car could be there now.
Maybe at night when we go to sleep, all of our cars go to the hotel right. and get used by the guests.
Could be.
Well, here's the thing. I don't ever check the mileage before I go to sleep.
I know. You don't check a lot of stuff.
Fact. So, okay. So go figure. I don't know what's going on. But guess what? The Verge is totally in there. Kevin hops in and's like, spill it, friend.
He's like, why are you wet?
No, he said, I saved a girl who was drowning in the pool. And then she's like, wait, you were in the pool? Did you drink any of the water? He's like, how? I didn't drink any.
He's like, don't drink the water. This turns out to be a pretty hot tip. Very important to know.
Yeah, but why do you think? What's up with that? I mean, I've heard the phrase, like, don't drink the water before, mainly having to do with pregnancy. I hear people say things like if you are at a workplace and several of the women might be pregnant, they're like, whatever you do, don't drink the water.
In Mexico.
Well, in Mexico, that's true, too.
Mm-hmm.
You might get parasite.
Yep.
Well, so, but you don't think there's any like cliched comment to that? Where like, I do understand that there's something about drinking water in, is it Hades?
Man, should have looked that up.
Okay, so I looked up the water potential symbolism, and it says that the river, I'm going to pronounce it Leth, flowed through the plain of Leth and Hades, also known as the river of unmindfulness. The river flowed around the cave of Hypnos, where the murmuring induces drowsiness. The shades of the dead were required to drink from its water in order to forget their earthly life.
That sounds pretty dead on here, doesn't it?
Like that?
It?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought you'd say.
Yeah, that's a gold star for you.
Thanks, Paul. So, then Kevin's like, hey, guess what? Somebody just tried to kill me.
And Verge is like, well, given your chosen occupation, that makes a lot of sense.
You know what's weird? When he said that, I completely thought he meant him previously having been a cop. Meaning, like, there'd be people maybe he killed in the line of duty or put in jail or something like that, that would, like, want revenge on him in this world. That's what I thought. So then when he like goes on to say, what do you mean my chosen occupation? And he's like,
oh, well, you're an international assassin.
I think that is the wonkiest crap ever. Is that a profession? International assassin? That's a profession? Do people grow up to be international assassins? That's a thing?
Well, sure. I mean, we've seen the Kingsman.
Do you think in the case of just like, that just means you go around killing people? That makes you an international. Like, have you killed more than one person in more than one country? You are an international assassin. So he says, that is why you checked into the hotel. Now, Kevin is like bleary-eyed. Like, are you joking me with this crap? What are you talking about? And he's like all, what? And he's like, listen, I drank the poison you gave me. You said you were going to bring me back alive. What am I doing here? And Verge gives the total lost, sideways, flash forward, flashbacks answer here.
Well, this did remind me of the final season of Lost, in that the whole scenario of the hotel, international assassin, and what Virgil goes on to describe as the presidential campaign and the donation that Kevin supposedly made to have the meet and greet and blah, 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 and all that stuff having been set up prior to Kevin actually arriving to the hotel. If you recall from the final season of Lost, how...
Spoiler alert, if you haven't watched Lost, fast forward.
And having happened several years ago, I don't believe in spoiler alerts for things that happened several years ago, so get a life. That all was a tool that Damon and those writers used similarly, where in this kind of afterworld... meeting place for souls waiting to move on to kind of like a more permanent afterworld, okay. You know,
uh-huh.
It was sort of like a way to deal with stuff that they needed to deal with in order to move on. Right.
Okay.
But they needed a way to process it before doing so, but they needed kind of the tools in order to do so.
Okay.
But it took all season, if you recall,
I do.
In order to explain it. And here,
They just kind of say it in like a couple sentences.
They just
right?
gave it all to us all at once.
So he basically says, like, you need to stop thinking in straight lines. Like, that's like the first piece of information, is that this is not just like, yesterday I was drinking poison, today I'm in the hotel. And he's like, no, like, it's not like that. It's not a straight line situation. And he says specifically, you know, she's not going to think like that. She's going to think in circles and zigzags and all these different ways. So you've got to like start thinking of the world basically like, what is that, like four-dimensionally, I guess? I don't even know what is the right term for that.
Probably because
it's like time is not just, it's not linear, right? It just, there could be.
Well, what we find out later does impact things. Yeah, you're right. Because it does happen
concurrently.
And
but yeah. Like in a, but like kind of like in on a different plane or whatever. So there's many things going on here. So it turns out that Patty is the she he is referring to, and that Patty is running for president. This is wild. So Virgil tells him, like, look, I only have like one time to explain this. Do you understand? And then Kevin's all, no.
No.
I like that. No. This is what he says. Here's a straight up story. Kevin Harvey is a generous contributor to Patty Levin's presidential campaign. Giving $50,000 earns you a meet and greet. So here's what you're going to do. You are going to go to the meet and greet. They're going to pat you down. You're going to have no weapons with you. But once you get inside, you're going to ask to use the washroom. And inside the toilet tank, there will be a gun and a silencer. The important thing is that as soon as you step out of the washroom, you need to shoot her. You need to know that she will try to deceive you. And this is so important because this is such a twisty mind field that they're having to go through here, right? Like, I mean, you're going to see things and experience things that, like, you're trying to use your, like, earthly mind to deal with. And, like, he's trying to tell him, like, don't listen to this other things, because she is going to be basically being able to run all around you without you even realizing it. That's all you have to do. Shoot Patty. And then you will be delivered from this place.
And Kevin is like, you mean like the Godfather?
I love it. Virgil's all smiley. He's like, do not hesitate. So here's a funny thing about that whole thing. So doesn't it feel like that's one of those lines where you feel like in the writer's room, they're like writing or whatever. And then somebody goes like, do you mean like the Godfather? And then the other writer's like, yeah. And they're like, let's just have him say that.
Yeah, kind of.
Doesn't it feel like that? It's kind of like our magical black man from previous. Like, do you think they're going to be talking about that? It's like, let's just have the character say it.
Or if you could think of it like, this is Kevin's afterworld reality, right?
Okay.
And if it's Virgil acting as his guide, so it's kind of these two peoples. So maybe, just maybe, this is just a guess. These are two guys. We don't know this, but maybe somewhere these two have a favorite movie in common, right?
Oh, yeah.
Just a guess.
Well, if life's a zigzag, maybe they're best friends. Maybe they're a married gay couple in another plane. We don't know. That's their favorite date night movie. I don't know.
Godfather could be a movie that they just really like.
Fact.
And maybe they just, that's the way they would run an assassination if they had to.
Love it. You love know? It. Yeah. So he asked a good question, right? He's like, Kevin's all like, Virgil, why are you still here then?
And Virgil says atoning.
And does that make your stomach so queasy? Like, why? What did you do? I really, really hope. Do you think they're going to answer that for us? Do you think we're going to ever find out what Virg actually did? Straight up, or is it always just
I think we
left?
Got what we need. I think
will you speak for yourself, because maybe I needed a little bit more.
I think he molested either John or Michael. This is what he's got to do to make up for it. If I was John or Michael, helping Kevin has got to somehow have some payoff for one of them, right? Somehow he's got to pay off bringing Evie home, right?
I would hope so.
Because otherwise, what has helping Kevin got to do with them?
Yeah, I agree.
Anyhow, over Virgil's shoulder, we can see a van load of people clad in white.
Oh my God, and I totally recognize Gladys. She looks like she's like a Hillary Clinton wannabe in her little pantsuit getup.
Because she's wearing makeup and stuff.
Yeah, she looks all fancy. Like, they are wearing white, but they're wearing like tailored white.
And he says, it is not safe for you. Do not let them see you.
And just don't monkey with them, right? Like, it's just bad. So the next time we see Kevin again, he is standing in front of the wardrobe again. We zoom back in on that plaque again. Only this time when he opens it up, there's only one outfit available.
It's another suit. All the others are gone.
Okay, so I have a question mark. In that moment, did that make you feel like, is someone else in use of these outfits? Or did it make you feel like, well, you've made your pick, now the wardrobe only produces the outfit you chose?
That's a pretty good question. Are you suggesting that another...
either person or...
missionary has come and is in need of selections, jobs, occupation selections?
I don't know about missionary, but that another person came through the porthole, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
and needs to make their choice of outfits, and they chose something else. Or even, I'll even like be a little bit more like out there. What if Kevin has come through the porthole several times now? Maybe he's like come and gone and whatever. I don't even know. I know for a fact we've seen like Simpsons episodes like this where there is like some sort of like they almost pass each other kind of things. Like, don't you remember episodes like that? Which I'm the one that introduced Paul to the Simpsons hardcore. And I love the Simpsons so much. And then every once in a while in some of the seasons, there'd be the one where I'm like, oh no. Oh no, someone brought the special brownies this week to the writer's room, because like the entire episode is like magic elf land and everyone's like super like LSD tripping and whatever. So I definitely felt like this kind of had that feel of like Kevin could absolutely pass Kevin in the hall, like for sure, no doubt.
But whatever the case, they are not there anymore.
Okay, so he is getting himself ready and he realizes that there was actually a card in the flowers, and he opens it up and it is kind of one of those almost like Ziggy drawings of a guy standing next to a well, and it says, get well soon. So ha ha ha, it's like one of those goofy puns. And he opens it up and it's blank.
In the main room, the TV goes nuts again.
Oh my God, that squealing sound. Ooh.
And for a second, you could swear you hear Kevin Sr. go something about feeding the fire.
He says, keep feeding the fire. I think I see something.
And the fire alarm starts to go off again.
In Kevin's room. So super interesting that like, now here's a funny thing. You know how like when someone is like making up a rumor or something, I've heard my mom say some comment like this. It's a very momish thing to say of like, you're just fanning the flames kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, so when he said keep feeding the fire, and we're so early in this episode, it kind of made me feel a little like, I don't know, like some sort of poking at us. Like, what are we going to do next? Like send in a guy like dressed like a monkey or something, you know, like just keep feeding the fire. Keep making this crazier and crazier and crazier and crazier.
Kevin takes the fire alarm seriously and he heads out into the hallway where he sees the big guy and the little girl heading back into their room. And he's like, aren't you guys going to evacuate? And they're like, no.
Yeah, the fat guy's like, it's just a false alarm. And then Kevin's like, well, what if it's not? And the fat guy's like, then we'll burn. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a guy you want to have in charge of kids.
Dad of the year. Kevin goes all the way outside and he passes a man and a woman arguing in Spanish. And Caroline went to our team of translators here at Daily Review.
Right.
Our intrepid team of translators.
She is telling the guy to let her go, that she has a human heart, and if she is not able to pass, something bad will happen. And the guy says no, and he's not letting her pass. So that cooler that she has, that she's like kind of, he's blocking her in the staircase. So she says that she's trying to get by because she has a human heart. Now, this appears to be the same woman that we saw down in the parking garage, and down in the parking garage, she was saying that she's nervous because she's not a doctor. So this was super interesting. Also interesting is above them, over the banister, you can see some balloons there. And one of the balloons says, congratulations. And another one says, it's a boy. And so Kevin like proceeds around the perimeter and is heading up the stairs where he walks directly to the balloon delivery man.
And here, Kevin, you know, since this weird hotel thing is obviously all about Kevin. He's right. Are those for me? And the balloon man, I guess when he showed up in the hotel, his wardrobe had like balloon delivery man, international assassin, and priest.
Bellhop.
Yeah, he chose balloon delivery man.
/ bellhop.
Yeah, and so
he said, looks thrilled with his chosen occupation.
Yeah, he says, "Is your name Mary Jameson?" And he's like, "No." And he says, "Then I guess they're not for you."
That was like kind of awesome. But here's the thing. I mean, weren't you like immediately like, Mary Jameson? Mary Jameson is in the hotel? Okay. Yeah. So this is really freaking me out now because first of all, it says it's a boy. Congratulations. Okay. What the what? Is it possible that, you know, time is not the same in the mortal world, if you will, as what we're going through? Is it possible that she had the baby already? It was a boy and that they both died? Because we've kind of figured out at this point that this is a whole hotel situation of potentially dead people, right?
We have our suspicions that this is the other place, right? I gave Caroline the air quotes of this is the other place. This is like heaven's waiting area, right?
Right, right, right. So we're in the waiting room.
But we have enough to go on to make this a very sad thing, right? That Mary Jameson is a resident of the other place, meaning that in Princess Bride terms, she's mostly dead, and that she's getting baby boy balloons, and baby boy is also mostly dead?
I don't know. It feels bad and weird, but it certainly puts Mary in a strange category here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know that she is supposed to be... It's weird. This vegetative state that she's in is hard for me to identify because she seems to be able to do some things, but not others. It's almost like she's paralyzed from like the
Well, you know eyes. About the reactive stuff where she was like rubbing her hand with the lotion and stuff.
No, but she can move her eyes back and forth and like those and blinks and she can breathe, which is that's the part where I feel like, okay, well, she can't be like completely brain dead because she wouldn't be able to breathe. And so she doesn't, it's not like she has a trach and a breathing machine and stuff for her, you know? So, I mean, so some part of her body is working, so that would imply that her brain's not inactive completely, you know? But I don't know exactly what it means.
We are not medical doctors.
No, it turns out not
here
unlike the
at the Daily Review.
Woman who's nervous about not being a doctor, we are also not doctors. But it definitely puts Mary in a strange category for us.
Kevin follows the balloon man where he...
Much to our chagrin, right? Because what were his instructions from Virgil,
to
Paul?
Stay in the room.
Stay in his hotel room because why?
It is not safe for him.
So he's going to go poking around like a little monkey?
He does see Mary down the hall receive the balloons.
Yeah, she comes walking. Not in a wheelchair or anything, walking right out and
at least she's got that going for her in the Hotel California.
Balloons. How dare you say that? That is totally a theory of mine.
Oh, sorry.
So, well, fine. I'll just speak of it now. So, you know, in Hotel California, the song, how it says, you know, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
It's yes.
Very reminiscent of this situation here.
It is.
So there.
It comes up later, doesn't it?
I don't know.
All right. So as he's kind of spying on Mary, someone pokes kind of a gun.
Not even kind of a gun. It's an actual gun.
An actual gun.
Yeah.
Into his neck.
His neck! In the back of his neck, right? And he gives him the old, "Are you Kevin Harvey?" You know, I think of myself in that situation. If someone shoved a gun at the base of my neck and then asked me any name, whether it be my own name or anyone's name, I would love to know what the damn right answer is. Do you always say no? I mean, is that really the right answer? Because, I mean, no one would do that. And then you say yes. And then they take the gun down and be like, "Whoo, good." Like, right? Like you almost always have to say, "No, I'm definitely not that person." Just that's a life tip from me to you.
Fisticuffs ensue. Kevin starts to kind of get a handle on it, but they fall into an elevator where there are more waiting GR goons. And he cannot overpower this number of goons.
Nope, it's a goon overload.
It's a goonorama.
Goonorama, right? Goonorama, if you will.
And they take him to kind of a service area.
So the next thing we see is the goons are handcuffing him to a chair.
They're hooking him up to a kind of a crude-looking lie detector.
I like that Gladys is doing some maintenance on the machine and like replacing the red light bulb on the top. That was awesome.
You know, I've seen a few police procedural type shows before, and I don't know that, they actually do have a big...
A giant red light bulb on the
top. Red light bulb on
I thought it
like
was
that.
Just like that, like, metal arm that's like, like, doing the like, almost like the heartbeat, you know, up,
yeah.
down, up, down. And then when you lie, I thought it goes like, scribble, 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 scribble.
Right.
I mean,
for,
that's
for
just
an expert
my...
to read later.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, it's like, how many scribs did he scribble scrabble during that question, right?
Yeah, this just had like
this
a pulse ox on your finger, right?
It was just a pulse ox. For any of you guys who don't know, that was just a pulse ox. Like, we had to use that for with our kids for like over a year. And like, yeah, it's just a pulse ox. All that's going to do is say like 99% oxygen in his blood saturation. That was not going to tell them. Well, it wasn't going to do anything that was going to light up a red light bulb.
No.
That was weird. That was very funny. It was like they didn't even want to look to see what a lie detector machine looked like when they made the scene.
He has to give his real name and he gives his alias.
Right. Bad news bears. You know what happens then?
Windex in the eyes.
Yeah. Do you think that that's their standard protocol, or it's just those were the cleaning products that were around? Do you think like if there was like if they were like in a lab and there were tweezers, they would have like pinched him a bunch of times instead?
Probably.
It was just like whatever you, I mean, you know what? That is a part of the job of the torturer that you really can't appreciate enough. Like sometimes
improvisation.
Yeah. You have to improvise with what you have around. You feel he had to decide like, am I going to spray him in the ear with the Windex? No. Am I gonna
like if you have to
put it up his nose? No.
Like if you have to torture somebody at like say at the library, you have
right.
to like slam somebody's hand in like a book a bunch of times.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Like you have to like
push a like shelving unit on
like
them.
Like you have to
like
stamp somebody
have.
With like the due date
yeah,
stamper
like hard.
A lot.
Like in a like on a sensitive part of their skin. Like that kind of thing, you know, right?
Okay.
Like you have to be thoughtful. Really thoughtful. So here he was. All he's got is some cleaning products. So he's got to go for the eyeballs, which, you know, again, as parents of a blind person, makes us throw up a little in our mouths.
What does she ask him next?
Well, he decides that the only way to get through this is to tell the truth. So he recants on his Kevin Harvey and says his name is Kevin Garvey, in fact. And she says, you know, why did you check into the hotel under a different name? Now he starts thoughtfully but truthfully answering the questions. He says, because I didn't want anyone to know who I was. She's all lousy alias. I love that he like actually laughs at this. Given that he has Windex in his pupils, I feel like I couldn't be laughing about anything. I'd be like, I'm done. Where's the eject button? I got Windex in my freaking tear ducts. So she asks several other questions, including basically, why do you want to meet Patty? And he says, you know, I just want to be in the same room with her.
If I was really screening people,
that does seem like a red flag, doesn't it?
Yeah, because she doesn't ask a follow-up. And that seems like if I was screening for assassins, seems like the sort of question an assassin would answer that way.
Right. She asks, like, why did you give $50,000? Like, what'd you hope to get out of it? And he says, you know, just to be in the same room with her. Which, whatever. But then she does ask, you know, do you smoke? Yes. Why do you smoke?
He says, I'm addicted to nicotine. Bing!
Dude, doesn't that seem like truthful, though? Like,
it does, because...
He is!
But then this part
That gets him another spray to the eyeball.
Yeah, and that eyeball guy, he doesn't just like go squirt, squirt. He goes squirt, 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 squirt. He gives several squirts to the eyes.
He does.
This next part is very curious and makes you wonder if Kevin is repeating the GR dogma that he remembers from his time in Mapleton or his time with Lori, or if he believes it.
Some part of me is going to go with believes it.
Because he says, I smoke to remember that the world ended.
I don't know.
And the light doesn't turn.
Right. So that, I mean, in many ways for Kevin, I mean, his world did end. I mean, like it or not. Whether or not he's prepared to say that or not. I mean, his whole world, everything that he had, his family, his job, his everything, I mean, it did come crashing down.
And so, he was smoking on October 14th, not the exact same time, but on that day. that was a significant part of that day, was smoking.
Well, and definitely the symbolism of it for anybody is going to remind you because the GR does it, you know? So
instantly, Gladys says, uncuff him.
Yeah, she's like, he's good. Yay.
Want some water? No.
Yeah, thankfully. And then the buzzer's like, like, he says he's not thirsty. So she's all like, I hope you understand. We had to go through this. You know, we got to vet everybody. Just, you know, why don't you go and clean up, like, back in your room. And, you know, we'll come and get you when she's ready for you.
Back upstairs in Kevin's room, Kevin is washing the Windex out of his eyes, and he hears the TV go crazy again.
Man, every time that I wrote, all I wrote was TV squealing. It was a high-pitched sound, man.
I have been, I don't know if you know this or not, Caroline, but I've been suffering headaches lately.
Yeah, I might be in on that.
And this episode with the fire alarm and stuff and the TV squealing was hard to watch.
Yes, Mr. Daly has migraines, and this was a doozy of an episode for that.
We got through it though, and this part was awesome. We took a couple times to watch, and this part was hard to watch because there was a lot of squealing. But tune in Tokyo, because Kevin Sr. comes in through the static.
He's saying, feed the fire. I think I see something.
He's wearing face paint and his face is right up into the TV screen.
I would say he's wearing like warrior paint, huh? Like war paint?
Something like
tribal
that.
Tribal kind of paint?
Yeah.
Kevin Jr. says, you know, where are you? And he says, I'm in Perth and I'm doing something called God's Tongue.
He says, I'm in the same room as you are.
Isn't that nuts?
And if you look right behind him, it looks like he is in the same room.
Yeah. Like the same painting on the wall, same everything.
Except there are looks like three, I'm not sure, but it looks like three Aboriginal men. Since he said he's in Perth, I think that's a fair assessment. Right. Aboriginal men behind him tending to this completely out of place campfire.
On the comforter.
On the comforter.
But here's the thing. I don't know if they're tending to it. They seem to be like kind of mixed bag about whether they want that fire to be going or not.
It's got
to
be just so, apparently. Right. Not too much, not too little.
Right. So he says he's on God's Tongue, which is some sort of drug is all that I can figure out. I tried to look up God's Tongue, and let me just tell you, there's a person named God's Tongue on Twitter, and he's a scary guy.
I was just calling it Australian Aboriginal peyote, my guess.
Some sort of hallucinogen. So he says, like, he really hopes it's real because, you know, he's hopped up on goofballs right now.
But the important news is that he was the one that sent the flowers. Now, this is kind of interesting because Kevin is in the other place. How can you send flowers to the other place? I don't know, but Kevin Sr. did it.
Right.
And what's interesting part due is that the card that came with the flowers that says, get well soon, should have read, take her to the well. So things get lost in translation when you are sending flowers between
to the undead.
Yeah, to the afterworld.
Right. So we should all note that somewhere just in case. Shenanigans. He's like asking, you know, what are you talking about? What well? And basically, Kevin Sr. is like, you got to be strong, Kevin. Got to be strong. This is like reminds me of like, you know, when newscasters are on location and they have like the earpiece in and the person's like, so, Joe, what are you going to tell me about? And the other person's like, yeah, it's snowing. And you're like, God, dog, what? Can you hear me? Can you not hear me? So Kevin Sr. is just like singing his piece because I don't think he can really hear Junior too well. But he does say, I love you. You got to take her to the well. And you got to be strong. It's going to be hard.
Kevin Jr. says, I love you too. And that's when the signal pretty well goes out.
Well, they do the prison like hand to the TV. Senior puts his hand like on the screen and Junior's like, touch.
That was a really interesting scene to me. That like, given that it looked like they were mirror images of the same room and with Kevin Sr.'s fire apparently setting off the fire alarm in Kevin Jr.'s hotel, it seemed like there was some cross-dimensional crosstalk, basically.
Well, the biggest thing is that the fact that Kevin Sr. could make a fire in one world, wherever the heck he is, and that the smoke would set off the fire alarm in Kevin Jr.'s world is the whole, like, what the what? Like, how is one influencing the other? You know, if he's supposed to be in Australia and we don't even know where we think Kevin is, then what is up with this?
And that he knew that he needed to be doing it.
Yeah.
That Kevin Sr. was on board, on the ball, on everything enough that he knew he needed. I mean, he went away,
months ago.
Weeks, right? Some amount of time. Because, you know, there was the, when they left the first episode of the season, they were still in Mapleton. Some time passes when they sell the house, move to Jarden, Evie disappears, blah, blah, blah. So that's just weeks, right?
Okay.
So Kevin Sr.'s had some little adventure, and he's managed to find guys to that he can take a pretty sharp tongue with.
Make fire with.
And burn down a hotel in Perth.
That's Kevin Sr. for you, man. He's gonna always have a gang with him, huh?
I guess.
Right at this time, we hear a on the door because the GR says that
the goons have arrived again.
Senator Levin is ready to see him. Now, as they're heading down to the area that they're supposed to see Senator Levin, they are going through sort of what I would consider like a service hallway. And coming the opposite direction is a man who has a black bag on his head and is handcuffed. Now, this is super weird because we haven't seen anybody else with a bag on their head like that. But as he grew closer, it was apparent to me, I made Mr. Daly here rewind it, that he was wearing the Mapleton police uniform. Now, since we saw that the uniform was gone from Kevin's wardrobe, when he got close and they actually like had to pass one another, the man was like the same size as Kevin, the same kind of build as Kevin, and just had the bag on his head. So it super made me wonder, was this Kevin when he made an alternate choice and he chose to play the part of the police officer? And it appeared, this is just my assertion, that if he was playing a game versus the GR, well, Kevin was walking freely with the GR as the international assassin, and the man who chose the Mapleton police officer outfit was handcuffed with a bag over his head. Seems like he lost the game.
That is as good a guess as any with what we have to go on. I will go with that.
Kevin heads into the security checkpoint here, and awkwardly, the security man says, "Make like Jesus."
And he holds up his arms as if to make like a cross.
Dude, if someone told you, "Make like Jesus," would you know what in the hell they were talking about? Even if you were at a security checkpoint, would that cue you to raise your arms in like a T position? Would you do that, or would you be like, what?
No, I would think that's a pretty crass thing to say.
What do they usually say? Like, can you raise your arm? Something like that.
Yes.
Right? Not make like Jesus so much.
No.
So then he proceeds to give him the pat down. There has been some conversation on this part that I would like to ask Mr. Daly. So as he's patting him around, he pats him in the groin area and then proceeds to say, congratulations. The first time I saw this, I thought that is kind of like the last area he patted. So I kind of thought he was like, congratulations, you passed kind of thing. Like I didn't find anything. But other people are asserting that it was like the jogging scene and the guard.
I'm afraid this passed me by.
The guard was like, congratulations. I think he was referring to Trip is what I'm saying. Kevin Jr.
This guy was pretty familiar with Kevin the entire time.
And kind of gross and weird and inappropriate the entire time.
Yeah, like when he asked him about his cut and then he called him harmless for putting Neosporin on his cut.
Well, okay, so do you think that that also harkens back to, do you remember Amy when he had the cut and Amy bandaged him up and she was like, did you put that Neosporin on like I told you? Remember that?
Yeah.
And then he had this condom in the hand, and the security guard's like, did you put Neosporin on it? A little callback. But then also, here's the thing that you and I talked about. So is it that if you were really a bad guy, bad guys like don't use antibacterial ointments? And so you're considered like a pansy and harmless if you've actually cared for your wound. I think that guy was very dismissive of proper hygiene.
That's how I read it, that the guy was referring to using...
If you use hygiene, you're a lame-o.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
that's what I was gathering too. Huh. So he heads on in to the like sort of...
Inner sanctum.
The inner sanctum, right, where they're going to do this like meet and greet with Patty.
Gladys is, she's already in there. She's like, oh, water under the bridge with all the, you know, the previous shenanigans.
Yeah, right. She had just been holding the Windex cleaning of his eyeballs. But Paul, this was like the part you were saying that is like identically what happens in The Godfather.
Pretty close.
So he actually uses that wording?
Very similar. There's a scene where Michael Corleone, he gets kind of worked over by a police chief that he later then has to kind of make nice with before he eventually kills him. And that police chief breaks his jaw. And when they meet up later, the police chief is like, so no hard feelings, right? Ha, ha, ha. And Michael's like, yeah, no hard feelings. And it's very reminiscent of that same thing. Because Gladys stands up and is like, water under the bridge, right? And Kevin's like,
Kevin
yeah, of course.
No choice but to just be like, yeah, no problem at all. So she goes through the whole thing. You can't talk about North Korea, gun control, abortion, or Neil. These are the four things you cannot discuss with her. You are going to take a picture with him. We're only going to take one. Don't blink. And then she proceeds to say again, don't blink. What? I really wonder about that, honestly. So he's like, yeah, okay, totally. So now he's remembering Virgil's words. Okay, so you got to get to the washroom, and that's where you're going to find the gun. So he's like, yeah, no problem. Can I go to use your washroom? And she says, be my guest.
He goes in there, and turns out the old washroom is ocupado currently.
But by a most surprising fellow.
He finds Holy Wayne pinching a deuce currently. And he's like, privacy, mate. And Kevin turns around and he's like, no, really, I meant for you to get out of here completely while I finish up.
Oh, gross. That was really gross. Well, I'm sure Kevin was like, I mean, can you imagine? What would you have thought if that was you? If like you had been given these instructions? I mean, okay, first of all, let me just say, I understand, I know for you, Paul, that walking in on another man taking a dump would have been horrifying all into itself. Paul is laughing so hard right now, he's in silent mode. He's got like the tears streaming down his face, okay? So you just have to imagine a red-faced Paul right now laughing to himself. But so if you had been given the instructions, like that's where your assassin weapon is, what do you do now? I mean, do you just like abort the mission, or would you like try to stick it out? Or would you be like, wait, I just left something in here. Can you just like, like, what would you do?
You do what Kevin does. You leave the room, and he does. And Wayne comes out. He's like, you know, I feel like I've met you before, but this is so strange. I feel like I've met you on the toilet before. And Wayne goes on to have, in a strange episode, what is probably the strangest conversation with Kevin, where he goes on to explain the power of the mind and the tricks that it can play, which, if you remember what Wayne did in his life, at least the part of the life that we know about, it makes a whole lot of sense, the little bit that he goes on to explain to Kevin about mind being so powerful that it can play tricks on you, and, you know, basically Wayne using his mind to play tricks on other people. Before Kevin can make his way back to the bathroom, Wayne hears on his earpiece that Patty has entered the building and that room.
What struck me about Holy Wayne's conversation was that you and I had this conversation last week about the concept of Patty, whether she was an imaginary friend or if she was truly some sort of specter.
Right.
And my whole thing was that it just doesn't matter because your mind is so powerful that the idea that if you respond in every single way that you would have, if she was 100% real, as you would if it was simply your imagination, but you 100% believed it, then the question just doesn't even matter. The answer here is moot. It doesn't matter because it's like, no matter if the thing is there or not there, your mind is so powerful that it can make sense of it. So,
but Wayne's explanation of it kind of shows what it's like when that power is being handled by a crazy person, because his explanation is like loopy because he's like, and tricks are, and Kevin's like, for kids? He's like, yes, for kids. And it's like, yes.
Well, okay. He does say that deja vu is the power of your mind to take something that's happening in the present moment and confuse it with a memory. I thought that was like an interesting concept because that's part of what is going on with Kevin in real life. There's these things where he's like having these real moments and then he's flashing back to these other moments. And he's sort of like a little bit confusing the present situation for a memory. And it's interesting, you know, we don't know a lot about his sleepwalking ways. But again, we sort of know his mind isn't thinking clearly. And so it's fascinating. I found it fascinating for them to actually address the concept that the mind is so powerful and you can believe so wholeheartedly in a memory. And it could turn out that that was just something that your mind made up, you know?
Mm.
It's all very wow.
Patty comes in before Kevin can make his way into the bathroom. And she wants to have a whole discussion on the security measures that she has to go through because they have very credible evidence that an assassin wants to try to kill her. And she wants to discuss assassins' motivations and why anyone would want to kill her.
I really appreciated her definition of the motivation for assassins because I felt like what she said was actually completely truthful. You know, the idea that assassins don't kill for revenge or money or anything like that, but they're motivated by beliefs. When I like quickly like ran through the only the couple of people that I knew in my head as assassins and knew enough of their backstory, I was like, hey, that's right. Like they do it because they have this like fundamental issue with the beliefs. It wasn't about trying to get money or revenge or anything like that from them. It was just because they just didn't agree. What was interesting is that Patty said it's not that they didn't agree. It's that they actually do have this like deep-seated belief that is the same as hers and that it's like they would rather put a bullet in her head rather than accept her truth. I think that's like, whoa. She's trying to basically say that her existence would confront their like deepest, darkest truths. And rather than sort of admit to it, they'd rather kill her. I don't know if that's true or not, but So she does say to him, you know, what do you think my truth is?
And Kevin says, you want to destroy families.
Now, Patty launches into the quintessential politician speech where she's like, I was in Iowa and I was like meeting a crowd. This sounds like every single story. You know how they're like, one time in Iowa, I met this plumber named Joe and Joe's just trying to make a living. Like, right? Doesn't that sound like the beginning of every single politician story we hear?
This one was a little different, though. This one ended with a man who just left a child in her arms.
Now, what was interesting here is that she didn't keep said baby or take care of said baby. She put that baby in an orphanage and said, like, that was a wonderful outcome for that baby because now that baby was not going to be able to attach to anybody. And they were going to have attachment issues for the rest of their lives. And wasn't that great? Because on October 14th, attachment and love became extinct. And so in many ways, by cutting this baby off from any family, they basically were creating the perfect breeding ground for Patty's beliefs.
Right. Difficulty attaching to people had now become a strength. I don't know why, but seeing the GR in this afterworld wasn't enough proof to me yet that this was a post-departure afterworld.
Okay.
I don't know why I didn't make that connection, like, solidly, that the afterworld would also be post-departure. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. But she goes through to go ahead and explain October 14th, and she said, you know, on October 14th, our cave collapsed, Kevin. Of course, I wrote cave, underline, underline.
Yeah.
Because we, of course, think back really fast to, you know, the beginning of season two with the cave collapsing under the earthquake. And she said, you know, we can spend our time digging through the rubble for signs of life, or we can transform. In that, I put in, like, parentheses, evolve, like Nora, how Nora kept kind of saying that she had transformed.
From there, she moved on. She said, how did you first hear of the Guilty Remnant? Kevin is starting to tire of this discussion. He says, I heard of it when my wife left me and joined up. Patty says, oh, that must have been painful. And he goes, well, no more painful than when your husband Neil left you. And Gladys stands up and says, oh, this meeting is over. And Patty's like, what did she say? Something like,
oh, you know, don't, you know, more no. people think it's a bigger deal than it is to me. But Wayne, can you go ahead and shoot this motherfucker in the face?
And Wayne, he wastes no time. He stands up, comes over and takes his pistol out, cocks it. And it commences to shooting Kevin right in the face. And Patty says, hold on, hold on. I'm just kidding.
He's all like, y'all are like all taking this all so seriously. At this point, Kevin's like, yeah, I really need to use the washroom at this point.
Because they're like, well, in all seriousness, we do need to go ahead and now and get that picture. And Kevin's like, well, wait a second. Let me just go get the, go to the bathroom. And so he goes in there. Very smoothly camouflages getting the gun out by turning on the water, coughing while he assembles it and cocks it and all that kind of stuff. By contrast, the gun Michael Corey Leone had to get out was nothing. It was all ready to go. The gun that poor Kevin has to get out is like a Lego set. He has to assemble it.
He's like,
and everything.
Side B into slot C.
Pretty much.
That's
but
awesome.
Luckily, he is ready. He's an international assassin, second to none. He comes out. Wayne's like, oh, shit. He gets popped twice before he knows what happens. Gladys has no idea what's going on. Gets popped once in the chest and she starts to kind of mumble, and then Kevin's like, you know what? Double tap. Bang.
She's trying to say, not her, not her.
Patty then changes accents and starts saying, no, no, she's not really Patty. She's someone named, I wrote down Rhonda Gennaro.
Uh-huh.
She's not really Patty. She's had plastic surgery to look like Patty. She's been trained up to sound and act like Patty. She's a body double. She's not actually Patty. Please don't kill her.
Which, thank God, Kevin like was like, nope, sorry. Was like, bye, Patty.
You or me.
Shoots her in the head, man.
Ta-ta.
Right? But then he kind of like puts the gun, like lowers it, and then waits a beat. Verifies, like, she's definitely dead, right? And then realizes, like, I'm still here.
Yeah, he's kind of, like, mentally going, Shazam!
Yeah. Right?
And nothing happens.
No, seriously.
Back down in the lobby, he needs to go check with old Verge to see what's up. He's done the magical words, and nothing's happened.
Virgil is mighty confused, and is just like, I don't know, you know, what you're talking about, sir. And he's like, what? And the bird starts coming flying over by him, and he takes the book and he smacks the bird dead. And Kevin kind of is like, gets that aha moment on his face. He's like, did you drink the water?
And Virgil's like, I was so thirsty.
And Kevin realizes, like, I'm on my own, man. I gotta, like, I have to put the pieces of this puzzle together alone.
Kevin returns to the elevator to go back up to his room. And inside, I don't think there's any significance to this, but you never know. Inside the elevator, there appeared to be a priest, Catholic priest, and he was an unhappy-looking priest.
He was crying, and my first thought was, like, I wonder if he was supposed to, like was he informed of the GR killings or something? And, like, maybe he has to go, I don't know, give last rites or something? I have no idea. Some other people were saying something like, you know, did it look like Matt Jameson as a young guy? I'm not seeing that. I don't know, but
Matt wouldn't be there. Matt's not dead.
Right.
And the GR wouldn't take it. I mean, at least the GR in the real world wouldn't take a religious ceremony.
Like last rites. I don't know then. I mean, I don't think that you put a crying priest in the elevator as the only other character in the elevator with him and have that mean nothing.
It's true. Damon doesn't waste.
No, I just don't.
Screen area.
Yeah, so we're still going to have to think about that one. We'll update the dailyreview.com as soon as we think of something. And if you guys think of something, please give us some feedback on our Facebook page at Daily Review or our website.
The other thing that happens is Kevin gets a notion to check his hand, his cut hand from the monkey knife fight. And wouldn't you know it, that hand is healed.
What do you make of that?
Well, it's not the real world. He's in the afterworld.
So
stuff heals.
Yeah, but then, okay, so then does that mean that those that he shot, maybe they didn't die? Can you heal? Could they have healed?
Well, I've seen lots of stuff, lots of media, you know, movies and TV that portray the afterlife, you know, and there's always different rules about dying again and getting hurt in the afterlife. And there's always a rule that if you're existing in that afterlife, getting hurt isn't usually so bad, but dying again in that afterlife usually means more permanent death. You know what I mean? So getting hurt is recoverable. Dying again usually means permanent death.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. All right. I'll go with that.
Because your mind kind of believes it, whereas your mind can be trained to get over incidental injury.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So he is heading back to his room, and Kevin sees the fat guy hanging out in the hallway drinking, and he's like half naked.
Kevin tries his door, and he's locked out, just like the fat guy.
Fat guy says that the girl's locked him out, or she's locked me out.
Fat guy offers him a drink. And at this point, there's only 14 minutes left in this show. Kevin's stuck in the afterlife, and I'm like, Kevin, this is not a good time to be sharing Jack Daniels with the fat guy.
I totally agree. Like, he's the last guy you want to be friends with. You do not want to share a drink with this dude.
But Kevin does not listen to my advice. Whatever the case, he does commiserate with the fat guy. And we learn a few things.
So fat guy asks him, you know, what do you do? What are you here for? And he says, I'm an international assassin.
Right. The truthful streak of Kevin Garvey keeps up. International assassin.
Right. And so he's like, oh, wow. Wow. And he's like, I didn't think they let you guys drink. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm done for the day. Like, and he's like, did you get your target? And he's like, huh, turns out it was a body double. And like the fat guy's like, oh, geez, they do that? Whoa.
Like Saddam Hussein. Oh,
yeah, that
right.
Makes sense. Yeah. And he's like, well, what do you do? And the fat guy's like, I don't do anything. I'm dead.
Well, before he gets to that, he says, great job to pick. He says, like, no wife, no responsibility.
No family, no kids, nothing.
And you remember, responsibility is a Kevin Garvey word. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something.
He always says, I have responsibility. I have to get back.
And that does resonate because he looks back at him when he says that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Where he feels like, you know, partially like, wow, did I just choose that?
Fat guy says,
he choked on a chicken bone.
Yeah, he says, I'm dead. Everyone's dead. Half the people here can't remember
their names.
Can't remember their own name. The other half are run around doing crazy shit like an international assassin.
So he says that he choked on a chicken bone. And he says, gotta listen to your mom. And then he does a really gross mom voice. And he's like, everybody swallow. Super gross.
This hotel then is
absolutely established now. It is the Hotel California, right?
It is.
Check out anytime you like, but you can't ever leave, right?
So it's like a purgatory type thing, you think?
Well,
it's
you
not
think
heaven,
he's saying that, but
it's not.
I don't know what it is. It seems like the only way to battle a dead person is to go on their turf.
I think it's very close to that last season of Lost. It's very, very much like that.
I know you keep saying, but I mean, Kevin had to go back there. It was just a way to go back to that space because Patty herself is dead. So in order to deal with your like spiritual demons, if you will, your baggage, like, it makes sense to me that you would have to go to their turf because you can't fight like a ghost, you know, and you're in the living world. Like, the living can't affect a ghost, you know,
mm-hmm.
You can't do anything. But so the whole idea that he had to like go to this other space, this other plane or whatever you want to call it, to go do battle with her. It's not exactly like purgatory in that, at least not for Kevin, in that like he's not dead on purpose, waiting to go to heaven. That's like not this whole point. The whole point was that he had to go to a place where everybody was living on only the spiritual plane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that he could finally be like on equal footing. That's mm-hmm. how I'm taking it. So like, I don't think that Patty was necessarily, I don't know what her deal was. I don't know why she's clinging on Kevin.
Well, I guess purgatory is a bad word because that's kind of like a biblical or Christian kind of term. I'm just kind of using it as like a, I don't know, a placeholder word for just a generally accepted non-heaven, non-hell afterlife.
It's just a spirit world, though.
Yeah.
It's a spirit world because, I mean, there are people who are there who have no intention of staying there. Like purgatory, there's no option to go back to the living.
No.
So then it's not purgatory, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because you can't go back to being alive. So then it's like, I'm just going to call it like the spirit world. Like it's just a place where there are souls that are sort of like not at rest, if you will. They're not done doing what they need to do in some way. Or they can't rest, whatever
like,
that whole thing is.
If you believe that Mary did wake up, then the hotel is the right place for her. Because
maybe she floats between.
Yeah.
Right, between the living world and this kind of spiritual place.
Then it's okay for her to get baby balloons there. Because then it's not sad. Because
maybe you're right, yeah.
Babies can come from there and it's and
that's
it's
true.
And it's not sad.
That's very true. So it's okay. Right. So it all depends on hopefully she's just not drinking anything. You know?
Yeah.
Pregnant women are kind of funny about that kind of stuff. So we'll have to see. So old Neil says, I've been stuck here and, you know, I'm so bored. I've nothing. I can't do anything here. And I can't even find a single woman to take a dump on me.
And Kevin's like,
the face he gives him was like, Neil's already like, oh, you judging me.
Kevin's like, is your name Neil?
He said, yeah, my name's Neil. So Kevin's all like, you know, and you've got that little girl like locked in there. And he's like, oh, you think I have a little girl locked in there?
This is great. You know, the show only has 10 episodes a season. So we only get to see certain things from certain people's points of view per episode, right? So sometimes we get to see from Kevin. Sometimes we get to see from Nora's. This episode is from Kevin's point of view. You know, we'll never get to see from Neil's point of view. But if you get to see this episode from Neil's point of view, who do you bet is inside that room? A little girl?
No, I think it's like the most ferocious, snotty, smart mouth, nasty.
Right.
Just repugnant. And just somebody who's just ignorant and, yeah, repugnant is the word I will use.
Yeah.
So he does think it's like comical that Kevin sees a little girl. Neil says, you should have let the fat see you next Tuesday drown. And that is what puts Kevin over the edge.
Oh, right.
So he hands the bottle back in that hanging on to the bottle, not really handing back kind of way. And as Neil kind of jerks it from him, he kind of falls back a little. And Kevin takes this opportunity to go ahead and snap Neil's neck.
Caroline caught that this is a modern retelling of the knight slaying the dragon because...
Oh, it's very fairytale-esque. I mean, it holds all of the same symbols that you would find in any fairytale story. There is the maiden in distress, there is the knight outside, and there is the some sort of ugly, gross creature guarding the door. And once he kills Neil, all he has to do is tap on the door, and the little maiden opens the door.
She's wearing a sign.
It's super sad. This is, like, heartbreaking. She's wearing a... She has a note, safety pinned on the front of her shirt. That says, I need to keep my mouth shut. My heart, like, broke in two when I saw this. I have to say that as somebody who, like, 100% despises any type of entertainment that includes child abuse or a child being abused, I have to say that they did a brilliant job of portraying a little girl who is being absolutely tormented and abused without ever showing Neil lay a hand on her. And I think that is amazing. And if that does not show you the power of your own mind, when you just see that note, your mind like fills in the gaps. Like you can practically hear the nasty words he would have said to her or how belittling he would have had to have been. And she's in there, like, with him, like, outside the door. Like, she doesn't have to keep that note pinned to her. She's locked him out. But yet, it still stays on there. Like, the how little she thinks of herself at this point is just crystal clear.
Well, it keeps up in their interaction between Kevin and her.
But do you get what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They showed the abuse without ever showing the abuse.
Yeah, I didn't process it. I mean, I observed it, but I didn't really process it.
But you know how I feel about, like, if we saw even 1 second of him actually abusing her, if we saw 1 second of him, like, hanging over her, yelling at her, I would have been like, I have to turn this off. Like, I can't watch this.
Yeah.
So isn't that, like, kind of amazing filmmaking, if you will?
Yeah, your mind filled it in.
Completely. Like, when you think about it, you could probably repeat back, like, what you saw and then be like, no, wait, I didn't ever actually see any of that. It was just, like, alluded to. When the door opens and the little girl is there, she says, hi, Kevin. And he says, hi, Patty. And this is the first, like, 100% confirmation to all of us, like, the little girl is Patty. So Kevin crouches down, sees this nasty note on her, unpins the note, and is basically, like, in that moment, like, he is, like, taking all of that off from her. You know, he's killed the horrible creature outside the door. He is, like, taking this note off of her. Like, that is no longer what you have to deal with. Takes her by the hand. She says, you know, are we leaving now? And he's like, yeah, we are.
Kevin takes Patty downstairs to the lobby where they find the concierge, a newly lobotomized Virgil, and they ask him to find a nearby well.
He acts definitely like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he does say, like, do you mean the caverns? Which, again, because we're from around here, the Natural Bridge caverns are, like, right around the corner from Austin. So that's like, oh, okay, that's funny. And he's like, no, it's got to be a well. So he finds a well outside of Jardin, Texas brochure.
Yeah, you just take the 55.
The I-55.
Which is fictional. and the way he refers to it as the 55.
That's not a thing. We don't say that.
Yeah. Maybe people from the California talk about
the I-anything.
The roads like that.
That's not a thing here. So So that was like funny and definitely off. But so they say, you know, hey, so we're going to go to the well. This was like such like brilliant acting. He's like, as they're walking, Kevin's like, yeah, we're going to go to the well. Patty goes, yeah, he's going to throw me in.
And Virgil looks down at her with this like, you know, just kind of grown up, what would you call that?
Like pandering to a kid.
Yeah. And says, well, I hope you bring your bathing suit.
Young lady. I hope you have your swimsuit with you, young lady. And he's like all laughing, like, like a little like sassy, like, enjoy your swim in the well. Crazy. So as they're walking out, there's a silhouette of them that a lot of people are comparing to the silhouette in Fight Club. And you'll have to just see those shots on the leftover chat on Facebook.
As they're driving, Patty's reading the pamphlet that she got from the concierge about the well. And she reads an important line that the well is considered a conduit between worlds of the living and the spirit world. All the other stuff, who cares? But that seems to be the sentence that matters here.
That, right. I mean, she calls it the orphan well. And then the last line that I jotted down was that you throw whatever you want to unburden themselves of into the well.
We get to the familiar Jarden/Miracle Bridge. Off to the side, we can see some encampment campers, but strewn around on the Jarden Bridge, we see junk and like burning barrels and stuff.
I think it's the burning barrels. I think the idea is that you can't drive on it.
Yeah, it's impassable in their car.
That's important. So a man comes over. Now, all we can chalk this up to is sort of that feeling of like, or the storytelling where there's like a troll on the bridge where they have to like ask you questions. Normally, you know, isn't it like three questions or something like that? Or you have to answer three questions, or there's in the like Grimm's fairy tales. I'm trying to remember. He's like, he has to ask you three questions, or you can ask him three questions, or these types of things. So in this case, he immediately tosses a
noose around Kevin's neck.
And he starts pulling him by the noose.
He breaks the window and pulls Kevin out of the car. And he says,
you have a choice. You can either cross or you can jump. And he says, why would I jump? And he says, because you don't want to kill a child. And Kevin tells him, she's not a child. And the man says, yes, she is. And if you kill her, you will not be the same.
Kevin says, this isn't real. And the man says, this is more real than it's ever been.
Then there's a series of whispering, and we're starting to see it from the point of view of Patty. So we are sort of further back from the guys. I'm wondering if we're going to find out what it is that he was told in that moment in some sort of flashback.
I think we'll find out at some point.
You feel that way? So one of the things that is noted here by Ryan Hamilton on Leftovers Chat is he says that when Kevin is about to cross the bridge, you know how there's the rope around Kevin's neck, that there was actually three other ropes that were already used. So doesn't that sort of imply that maybe the three other occupations had come and chosen to jump?
There have been a lot of three other things. There have been like the three girls could have come before him.
Oh, yeah, that's true. The three girls could have come. That's true.
Interesting. No, I knew I had seen that there were more ropes.
So that meant that other people chose not to cross. They chose to jump.
Yeah.
Intrigue. It does make you wonder if it's the three other girls, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know.
That's creepy. I hadn't thought about that. But thanks to Ryan for like making us stop and think about that.
But Kevin's like, no, I'm sticking with the plan. Thanks, dude.
Yeah. So he goes and he gets Patty out of the car, and she immediately starts to say that she's tired. And so he picks her up. They proceed to go on a very long walk, it seems, to get to the well. I completely noted, and Paul, you're a guy, so, and you've carried a young girl or two. There was something to me about the fact that they did make her be carried that way that sort of made me feel like, I don't know, it was kind of endearing in some way.
This whole time, she's been growing on him, you know? He had to save her from Neil, and then
save her from the pool.
Save her from the pool, and the kind of, you know, the kind of stuff you do with like correcting her when she mispronounces stuff in the car. And,
when she's trying to read.
Yeah. And just all the kind of stuff you do with.
And he's trying to kind of like nurture her, like when she's reading and she doesn't get it right. And then she's like, should I stop reading? Am I talking too much? And he's like, no, you know, go ahead. You can read.
Right. With the stuff that Neil had been tearing her down with, her self-esteem stuff, the kind of stuff that if a little kid was having those kinds of problems, and they're just so easy to nurture, that Kevin was having no problem just being like, you don't have those problems. Whatever Neil was telling you, those aren't the facts. You're not that way. And Kevin was feeling that way about her. So, yeah, she was growing on him even in that short amount of time that they were spending together.
Well, and even as like a little actress, I thought that the little girl was actually growing on everyone. Like, I thought she was like a likable kid, that the way that she spoke and the way that she was like kind of funny. And, you know, even when she didn't want to cross the bridge and she was like, are you scared? And then she's all, bark, bark, bark. And when he looks at her, if she'd been making a mean face, that'd be one thing. But she grins at him, like, just making a joke, you know?
Yeah.
So given what I just said, though, do you think that the physical act of carrying her is something that would be endearing? Like, to me, I think when I can feel the weight of the child that I'm carrying and I can feel their heart against me and she's kind of noozled into his neck and carrying and like has her arms wrapped around his neck and stuff, it's a very specific feeling, I think, that's invoked. Do you feel that? Because you're a man. I can't relate in the same way. I'm a nurturing mother, so I don't know what it feels like to be your role.
Yes, but Jill's got 17 years on this kid, so sorry for Patty. She loses. That's just the way it's going to go with Kevin, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it surprises me that he is... I'm glad for it, but it surprises me that he's being so straightforward, you know, like he's not wavering, you know, even though it's hard to do, he's not wavering about doing it.
He doesn't forget where he's at.
Or what the mission is here.
Right. He sees where he's at. He's at the exterior of this large stone well.
Which is identical to the card that he received. The picture, the drawing of the well looks identical.
The little girl, Patty, makes it as hard as possible by talking and talking and talking.
You're so funny.
Would you like to drop me or push me? And she begins to list all of the
reasons faults, she deserves it.
Yeah, all of the faults that she doesn't have as reasons why it should be very easy just to let her go into the well. I'm not going to list them here.
Did it shock you when he just put his hand out and she just disappeared silently, just fell right over the edge, just nothing?
Not exactly. I knew that sooner or later Kevin was going to do it because he had done everything else so far.
Did you expect her to scream, though, or to hear some noise or anything? It was just completely silent. She was just talking, 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 and then just... silent.
You know, I guess I just didn't have an expectation for her part of it. I knew Kevin would do his part of it.
So after she falls over, you hear the eagle screech. Totally reminiscent of the cave and the dying.
But then, grown up Patty. Kevin, I'm dying down here.
No, she says, help. Please help me. Right. That's the problem. She's not dying.
Yeah, not dying fast enough anyway.
No, she's not dying. I think she would sit down in the well if he didn't go down there. So Kevin starts stepping down into the well. Which I have to say, some part of me was like, no, like, please don't go down there. Because all I could think was that somehow this was deceiving him, you know? It was some sort of deception to get him to come down there. And then somehow this was like going to be the end of it, you know?
Yes, grown Patty starts calling for help. Kevin, help. Kevin slips. He's wearing his international assassin beetle boots on his way down.
Very, very sharp tips, huh?
Yes. And he slips almost instantaneously on his way down the interior of the well. He does hit his head a little bit, but he is not out. He gets back up.
So Patty starts telling him a story about how Patty was on Jeopardy and that this was her big plan to leave Neil. Basically, she had to win $50,000 and that would be enough to leave Neil. It made me think of, you know, how many times we've seen $50,000 be a number that has come up several times. You know, like Nora put down $50,000 on the rent house. There were other things that seemed like came up like several times, about $50,000. I feel like the point of the story was that she had actually gone on Jeopardy and she had successfully won the money she needed to win, but she doesn't choose to leave Neil. And so it's like, even when everything points to like you have everything you need to go, she doesn't choose to go. There's also another little nugget of info that comes out. She describes having an interaction with a fellow contestant. She talks about them being in the green room together waiting to go, and that the other contestant chose to stay completely silent in the green room and not interact with her at all. She felt the power of his silence. And honestly, it made me feel like, wow, that's kind of all the answer you need to know why she would make the GR not talk. Because she described the extreme amount of like control and power that silence held. And it was like, oh, there's our answer. There's like another great answer coming out of this. In the end, she basically tells him, you know, I couldn't leave. I had all the opportunity to leave. I could get out and I didn't do it. Kevin like cradles her and even kind of gives her like a kiss on the head. And then
just before that, she gives him permission. She says, I'm scared. And I think after that story, that it's almost like giving permission to say, you know, you threw me down the well. We all know why we're down in this well together.
And basically, and the fall didn't kill me. Like, and now I'm just sitting down in the bottom of a well.
I'm broken. I'm bleeding. And I'm not dead yet.
Yeah, like basically just finish it off.
Right. So Kevin comes over, puts her face down in the water, kneels on her back, and waits until she drowns. Which thankfully isn't that long.
No joke. We're ready for that to end. So do you think that that's 100% officially Patty is never to be seen again now? Is that got to be it? Is it got to be over?
That has got to be it. I mean, that is, how else, if she's not gone, then this show is cheating, right?
Yeah, I mean, playing by every rule, she really should be gone, right? This should be it. I feel sad. I'm going to miss Ann Dowd. She was so funny and so likable, and she had such a great presence on the show that we do have to have like a moment of like, she's officially gone, huh?
Yeah, it's funny how she could be so, you know, vile and likable, you know, at the same time.
Her character changed so much, though, over the course of the two seasons, I felt, you know. I mean, definitely at the beginning when you didn't know anything about her and you just saw her militant ways and how ugly and nasty she was to everybody. But then when you got the backstory and you got the little nuggets about Neil and you started to understand her relationship with Lori and just how broken she really was, I think that it worked for the audience too, you know, in the same way that it worked for Kevin. The more vulnerable she was, the more likable she was, and now we're straight gonna miss her, you know?
Patty dies and an earthquake starts caving in the well.
Which, okay, so let me ask you a question. Do you think there's any correlation between someone dying and then an earthquake happening? Because the only reason why I say is because I wonder about the night that Evie disappeared, there was an earthquake. And it makes me wonder, like, does that mean the girls are dead?
I think there's a correlation between Kevin doing something supernatural and earthquakes.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Interesting. So if Kevin does something supernatural, then that causes an earthquake, or those two things just come...
I mean, that particular earthquake on the night that
Evie...
And yeah, that was Kevin needing to be saved.
Right, so that the water would leak out, right?
Yeah.
Well, and we saw that the orphan's well was definitely right next to that same space.
Now the earthquake, the morning that Michael was setting up his vials, who knows what that earthquake was? I don't know. Remember when the guy was like...
Yeah, he was like, damn, frackers.
Yeah, that one? That one's fair game.
Hmm. Intrigue. Okay.
Because, you know, I don't think there's fracking around Austin, actually. But.
No, I don't think so either. That's a funny thing. But anyway, so as the earthquake is happening and the rocks are starting to fall in on the well, did you think that Kevin was going to get trapped down there?
Nope.
Really? Kevin. You didn't have any worries that the rocks are like hitting him on the back of the head? You really thought like no issue at all?
Nope. He starts climbing and he climbs for about a second and then he breaks through.
Yeah, and the screen completely flashes to nighttime and he is crawling out of the dirt, like clearly a grave situation. We've seen some zombies crawl out of the dirt before. That's what it looks like.
There's a campsite nearby. Young man comes running over, a familiar, friendly face.
Kevin meets the eye of Michael Murphy,
who says, "Holy shit." The Archangel Michael, as I call him, has redeemed one soul from the afterlife.
Yeah, seems to have popped up, man.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing episode. That was like 5 stars, man. That was...
It was amazing. The last song is I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned. I can't wait to listen to the soundtrack of this past episode and this entire season. There were so many good songs that were playing throughout, and I felt like they carried the emotion from not just the words and the actors' faces, but through the music and through their movements and the choices of this scenery, like inside the hotel, how they had chosen to basically use blue as like their color palette.
Well, this could have bombed. I mean, this was really bold, because this could have been just, I mean, this could have been a complete failure.
Yeah.
In terms of they just went way off track. They didn't go to Jarden. They didn't move the plot in terms of everyone else's story, you know?
Right. And I mean, we only have 2 episodes left of this season, and the entire season has hinged on this missing girls, but specifically Evie. And we really haven't gotten any further with any of that.
And you had to be kind of, you were telling a story that if your audience isn't an our audience, our modest daily review audience, if you're not with it enough to get it, whatever it is, they're just going to turn on something they can understand.
This is absolutely one of those shows that, I mean, overall it makes you think, but when they go on these side journeys like this, which they haven't done too much of in this series, but certainly having gone through watching Lost, you know, with Damon and Carlton, I definitely feel like, okay, you have to allow some amount of like suspending what you live in your daily lives and be willing to be like, but what if this exists and how would it look and what would it play out like? I think it's amazing. And I think that they really did a great job. I think showing Patty's background the way that they did, you know, they brought her full circle for me from being someone I hated to being someone I loved and sympathized with and had compassion for. And that's just very good storytelling.
It's like when Kevin got in the car with Virgil and Virgil said, "You can't think in straight lines. She thinks in zigzags,
circles, and weird shapes."
To follow this show, you can't think in straight lines.
Right, right. And you have to believe how powerful minds are, and that if it just took, but if everybody experienced a huge happening that was unexplainable by our belief systems, then what are the different ways people's minds could go? And just, I absolutely believe that having seen, you know, sad things happen to people or traumatic things happen to people, you suddenly don't think in a straight line. You can see people who think like zigzags and, you know, things don't work out the way you think they should by as Senior Garvey said, the natural laws of nature seem all turned upside down, right? They just don't make any sense.
Right.
Well, we have had a wonderful time analyzing this episode, and we know that next week's episode is going to be falling on the end of the Thanksgiving holiday week. So we apologize in advance, but that one's going to come out a little bit later so that we can all spend time with our families.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.